now, your Chilpac Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpac Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpac Hollywood Hour.
Dean Haglund, today when I could not reach you, I naturally assumed it was because of the ongoing Australia-USA feud that has erupted in the past few days. Are we at war?
Are we at war indeed? What the hell? I don't know. The Prime Minister here is renowned for being spineless, so maybe he just collapsed in the phone call. But it seems that there's a bit of hostility in the relationships here.
Oh, my goodness. We are treating our friends like enemies. And look, because we've used up pretty much all our BlizzTex kissing Russian butt. So there's not much left to kiss and make up not with much. Our actual friends. And when I say friends, yeah. I mean, boy... I will say this, there's always something good, there's always some way that that things serve, even when they turn out the way we don't want to, and the way that this Donald Trump belligerence towards the Australian Prime Minister served was it allowed me to read about just how astonishing the not only alliance, but friendship between Australia and USA has been for... lo, these many decades.
Absolutely. I'm saying 70 to 80 years of close relationships, shared military strength, shared trade deals, so many things aligned in concepts and culture. And yet here, one guy comes in and slams the phone down in 30 minutes and they're in 70, 80 years of good times.
On Colbert's Late Show, of course, he theorized, and they showed it in a sketch, that Trump had actually thought that he'd reached an Outback Steakhouse. So it's possible that there were... anyway, look, the tragedy of this conversation should not be... And I don't mean our conversation. I mean between the heads of state. Should not be... but literally I was concerned that maybe somehow all transpacific communication, look, I'm American. It can be whatever ocean I say it is. These are hashtag alternative facts, but
fantastic.
I really was concerned. There was a microscopic part of my reasoning that, froze. And I asked, is it possible that trans-Pacific links between Australia and the U.S. have been frozen? Because I could see what looked like you were not on Skype, then you were on Skype, then you were active on Skype, but you were neither calling nor answering my call. So I wondered if indeed it was politically related. But look, all joking aside, we do want to express that our hearts go out to the non-existent victims of the non-existent Bowling Green massacre.
Right. Now, I haven't followed this one so closely over the weekend.
Well, so we had what is, don't you dare call it a ban, just something that prevents people from seven predominantly Islamic nations from entering the country. Even right. If they had left this country with visas or green cards, they're not allowed back in. An executive order passes this sort of thing. What a drama this was. And probably will continue to be. But right. In defending this, because, look, reasonable people who look at facts will probably point out that in history, including if you count 9/11,
right,
as many people we know would not, but if you do count the deaths of 9/11 as being caused by Islamic immigrants in these lands, either illegal or otherwise, even if you count those, the percentage or the odds of being killed by an Islamic immigrant terrorist in this country is something like 0.0000001 of 1%.
Right, so you're saying there is a chance.
Exactly. Three, as we know, not counting 9/11, I think there are three such immigrants that have caused violence in this country's history. So anyway, the odds are very, very, very slim. But one act of violence and massacre we didn't know that Chief Presidential Advisor Kellyanne Conway used to support this, don't you dare call it a Muslim ban, was the three men who got here and caused the Bowling Green massacre. And that would have been stopped had it not been, you know, if we had had this don't you dare call it a ban in place.
Okay.
The only problem with that was there was no such massacre.
Right. So what was she mistaking? What was she thinking that was the massacre's real name?
Well, apparently there were a couple of immigrants who might have been involved in planning something and they were caught.
Okay. But at the Bowling Green?
Yeah, at Bowling Green University or in thereabouts. So maybe there was something like that. But look, in her own defense, using her own words, look, honest mistakes happen. anyway, look, all I want to say is our hearts indeed go out to the non-existent victims of the non-existent Bowling Green massacre. Also, and in fact, can we dedicate today's show to those non-existent victims?
You know, there's so many other victims, maybe, I don't know. How do we have to also tally up non-existent victims?
Well,
'cause I got a list a mile long of those.
God knows when we get to celebrity deaths, we're going to be setting a record today. I just want to point out also, it is African-American History Month here in the U.S. It kicked off with a bang with Donald Trump starting the festivities with a rousing speech about the, you know, the African-American History Museum there on the mall and in D.C., in the heart of D.C., and when he was paying tribute to so many great black Americans, and of course everyone has loved his touching tribute to Frederick Douglass when he spoke of the great abolitionist and freed slave, he has done an amazing job. That's what Donald Trump says. He has done an amazing job. Those words literally mean up until this point, he has done an amazing job. I can't wait for next month's update when Donald Trump wonders what Frederick Douglass has done lately. All right.
So
before
when you're literate. Yes, I know.
Before we get to celebrity deaths and as we leave, and I don't think we've been getting political aside. We're having fun talking about the events of the day. And what better segue from events of the day could there be than to something we like to call live events of the week? And really, so we do.
It's the Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
Last night, Dean Haglund, I felt like, again, I am becoming Dean Haglund.
What?
When I attend the 44th annual Annie Awards for the best in animation. Black Tie Affair over there at Royce Hall at UCLA. Have you ever attended the Annie Awards, Dean?
I have a couple of times back when I was voicing RoboCop Alpha Command.
This is what I thought. And were you a presenter?
I was not. No. I strictly had a table with some people from MGM. Had some drinks, ate the food, clapped, and that was the extent of that.
It's a big deal. It's a fun event. I don't mean this I don't want this to sound mean or pejorative in any way. And so please let me, everyone at home, say it. Don't turn off the podcast, because I will follow this up with another comment. But this was Nerd Prom. Black tie and ball gowns. No, I mean, honestly, there's under the tent, because they were worried about rain, big champagne reception and red carpet going on. And it was Nerd Prom. I mean, it was these, you know, it's very well-dressed people, all too scared to ask anyone of the opposite sex to dance with them. But there was music, there was live music, there could have been dancing if it were not Nerd Prom. But the reason that I say this is not to be mean, but to be factual, in that you and I have both heard, I think probably originally San Diego Comic-Con, but then more recently Dragon Con referred to as Nerd Prom. We've both heard that refer, and honestly, this really did feel like a prom. That's why I say it, because of the discomfort in the tuxedos. You know, I was just thinking about how, boy, when you watch the Oscars, you watch the Golden Globes, and you see these people all dressed up, the one thing you got to say is, they really do know how to wear formal wear. They really do. It's like they have teams that make it look like they were born into this clothing. But if you do not have a lot of experience and a lot of help with it, formal attire for both men and women can just exacerbate any feelings of awkwardness you have.
Right. Absolutely.
Because, you know, one wrong move, suddenly you've created a wrinkle, you've created an unfortunate line, you need to know how to do this stuff. And if you're worried about those things, boy, you come off seeming very nervous.
Well, absolutely. And I imagine if they're animators, they don't own their own tuxedo, much like actors do. So I suspect they're all rentals that are ill-fitting at the best of times. So
the best of times. Anyway, so big fun at the Annie Awards. When I say big fun, I mean pretty much a major snooze fest, because it's an award show. Dear God, 44 competitive awards and a handful of honorary awards. And yes, they keep it going quickly-ish, but, you know, the longest part of the night is waiting for all those people, many of whom are in cheap seats, to make their way up to the stage.
Oh, yeah, of course. There's a lot of dead air. I was watching a bit of it on live stream, and I turned it off fairly quickly.
Did you see me? I was the one in the white dinner jacket. I don't think there was anyone else. If you go back, you look. Some winners passed by. We were sitting next to, unfortunately, you would have seen more of me if your rooting interest had paid off, Dean Haglund, and if anyone from the BoJack Horseman team had won, you would have seen me, because we were seated right next to the BoJack Horseman team.
Look at that. Damn it. No, unfortunately, the live stream camera just points on stage. It doesn't cut away to anything else.
Well, that's why you need the magic of basic cable. Okay, so two things that I will take away with me that I loved was witnessing Lily Holloman and Jenna Elfman discuss Basquiat. That was a lot of fun to be witnessing.
What, on stage?
No, just in the party, just in the cocktail party.
Oh. Oh, yeah.
As you do.
Jenna's up on her
she
Basquiat.
She was wearing a Basquiat, so there you go. And
look at that.
And I got to talk with the president of ASIFA, I guess is how it's
ASIFA?
Pronounced. The Academy
ASIFA.
Of Animation, that puts on the Annies annually and does so much work for preserving the art form. Jerry Beck, who it's safe to say has forgotten more about animation than all the rest of us will ever learn. And I have enjoyed so many of his cartoon spectaculars that he puts on at CineFamily, especially this past year. Yeah. And so it was great fun to get to rub shoulders, rub elbows, rub Basquiats with that guy. Dean, last week I had referenced, I think, a trip to a sanitarium I took, and God knows I need one now. But so I want to tell you about that, but I'm curious, as we're talking about live events of the week, what's been going on with the live comedy that you do for the kids?
Well, that's been on hiatus a little bit during this heat wave that we have here in Sydney, because God forbid I'm going to perform and get all sweaty in a theater that has no air conditioning. So it's been a miserable couple of weeks here in an unprecedented amount of humidity and heat in Sydney. And once that's over, then we're going to get back to it. Comedy for the kids.
Well, and is this at your theater, the theater you're going to run?
No, this is at the 505 still we're talking about. The theater that I'm going to run has run into a few snags, as one does getting a company up and started, including financing, location, you know, getting a business started in a new city is always a fun hurdle of stuff.
Oh, okay. So all you have standing in the way is financing and an actual spot. But other than that,
yeah,
it's literally
a great idea.
When people say the theater of their mind, that's what they're referring to.
Totally. It's all in the mind, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So the other live event that I wanted to discuss with you, and again, I thought that this is something that would have been right up your alley. I went to the Rockhaven Sanitarium last weekend for a tour, and this closed...
For a tour.
Yeah.
Air quotes, a tour.
No, it's open one or two days a month for Friends of Rockhaven, and the first day each month, it's open for cleaning, and then the second day, it's open for a couple of tours. Because Rockhaven as a sanitarium closed down in 2006, and it was going to be turned into, I think, condos, and then the city of Glendale purchased it, although I would have thought that this is in the city of Montrose or Crescenta, because it's in the Crescenta Valley, which was established, Dean, as a place for sanitariums. At one time, 35 sanitariums in the Crescenta Valley.
Good Lord.
And this is the last one standing. And I guess the reason why there were so many was because the air is so clean up there and so crisp, and it makes breathing at that higher altitude surprisingly easy. I had been having a great deal of sinus problems in the first month of the year. And while we were up there waiting for the tour to begin, I noticed how immediately my sinuses had cleared up. So there is something to that. And and honestly, I don't know about, look, I'm no doctor. Let's not pretend. I have played one on TV, though, no, I really haven't even done that. But but I do believe that a lot of one's health and one's mental health often can be traced to how easily one is breathing.
It's true. And what we're breathing. You know, carbon monoxide levels are... I can smell them, so I naturally just shallow my own breathing when I'm out in traffic. And even today, garbage day, all the trucks driving around. Here in Australia, they have a there's no restriction on emissions for trucks over 750 kilowatts, which I don't know how you measure that, but... it seems most of the heavy-duty equipment around here is a straight pipe from the piston right to my mouth. So that's also why.
Well, that's convenient. That passes the savings on to you.
Exactly. So a lot of shallow breathing in Sydney during garbage day, anyway.
And
which is today.
And ever since that threatening, belligerent phone call from our president.
Yeah.
So this tour at the sanitarium, you know, look, I'm all about the preserving the history, right? And so there's a real effort by the Friends of Rockhaven to preserve the buildings and the grounds, try to make it some kind of public park so people can appreciate, since it's the last of its kind, the last sanitarium there, and that's how the area was founded. It's got certain historic importance to the development of that area. But
and this is mental health, or is this alcoholism, or what kind of?
Well, it was a place for women. It was run by women for women, though of course the doctors that visited would be men. But it was a business run entirely by women for women. It ran as a nonprofit for so many decades within one family, and it was a place for rest. They did not ever think of the people who were there as patients. They thought of them as residents who were in need of rest, of healing through peacefulness as much as anything else. And they lived very active lives while there. They would go on outings and they'd have, you know, social occasions. But they were, you could see enough where this was probably quite a refreshing difference from most sanitariums and institutions of the era.
That, right. You weren't locked up. You weren't put in a straitjacket or anything.
There was shock treatments going on, and and honestly, I couldn't be in any of these buildings for very long at all. I had to get out of each and every one of them.
Why?
Well, the smell, first of all, but secondly, just the feeling of them. I mean, it was it disturbed the heck out of me. I didn't mind being on the grounds. I liked the grounds, although I was always the first one out of the buildings at these in these cases. And as a result, I would see every so often a man in a hospital gown, you know, like open at the back, wandering in the distance.
What?
And then every so often, a doctor chasing him down and pulling him back into what looked to be the hospital. I could see the hospital building. But every time they would go into the hospital, they would vanish because the hospital had, you know, it was open. The windows were, you know, there's no blinds on the windows, no shades or anything. But they wouldn't be in there. They would walk in and evaporate from view. And the doctor was in very old-timey attire. At least 1920s, if my sense of fashion does not fail me. And when does it fail me?
Never. So you saw ghosts. Basically, you say this is a ghost sighting.
Well, so I didn't think that. I mean, it was odd. But, you know, I'm not someone who wants to see things.
Right.
So, although, as we both know from our premiere of Spectres, I have from time to time. And it always involves in the 1920s, doesn't it? But
it sure does.
So then Lily came out and joined I asked the tour guide. And the tour guide just looked at me confused. And
right.
Then I pointed when Lily came out and rejoined. And she's always the last person out of all these buildings. So then it's right. This fun thing of, what did I miss? What's the tour guide been saying? Well, if you wanted to know, then stop hanging out in the closets inside the resident wings of a sanitarium. But anyway, I pointed out to her, I said,
I support her, actually, on that one.
Do you see this patient? Anyway. Do you see the patient over there? No, what patient? And I said, but the doctor. And inevitably, I would point, she would say, I don't see anything. And then I would look, and they were gone. And again, every time... This happened, I think, 3 times total, 2 times with Lily, right? Where they would go into that building and then they would just vanish. So I'm really beginning to think I am seeing something and, you know,
right.
that no one else is seeing. We make it to the hospital wing and we go right. in. There's no sign of anything, although there's some recent stuff in there, which is kind of odd. You know, like the tour guides will tell ghost stories and about how things appear. And I'm just convinced that people on tours leave stuff. Like the next time I go
right.
back there, I'm putting a framed photo of me in one of the rooms. No, I'm kidding you not. I'm going to do that. I just think that would be awesome. me and a bowler, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Looking old timey. But anyway, I got there and there's no one in there and it is so damn creepy. It's just awful. I mean, an old hospital, an old derelict hospital that's decaying.
Yeah.
What could be worse than being in this place, right?
Right.
So I had to get out and I get out and I continue to walk along and then I see the doctor again. And this time I follow. And I follow the doctor and now there are more... figures dressed in 1920s style. And I'm thinking...
And is the tour with you, or is the tour...
No, the tour is back in the hospital or whatever. I've gone into a building that I don't know if we're supposed to go into. And I think I'm onto the mother load here, Dean Haglund. The mother load of ghost sightings. And then I see the display of donuts, which is part of craft service... And this doesn't make it any less odd, though. There is a silent film being shot there that day. And so it was an ocular illusion that they were walking into the hospital when I was missing them. In fact, they were walking behind the hospital building. And so it just looked from my distance like they were walking into it. And of course, my eyes told me they must be because they're dressed like a patient and a doctor. But they had set up a makeshift hospital set in another one of the empty buildings there. So it wasn't...
And shooting a 1920s old-timey silent comedy,
Well, I don't know if it was a comedy. I hope to hell it was not. But and it was not ghosts. It was not ghosts of a past shoot being there, or else these ghosts are at the very least, these ghosts are quite active on Instagram. So... As are we, by the way, at Dean and Phil. People can follow us at Dean and Phil, spell out the and. We post one thing a week, and we give good hashtag. So anyway, so that's that's my tour of Rockhaven Sanitarium, and I hope that was enjoyable for you.
I think so. I want to see the silent film now that they were making.
Yeah. I might actually try to find out about that and tell them that we spoke of it a little bit. They might get a kick out of what I just described on the podcast.
I think that sounds entertaining.
And we can shame people into listening, one listener at a time. All right. From
the marketing plan.
From phony ghosts and non-existent victims of non-existent massacres to the very real dead, we have an unprecedented amount of bodies to discuss on this week's Celebrity Deaths.
Celebrity Deaths.
First up, the musicians, Dean Haglund, because who loves music more than you? And the answer to that would be pretty much everyone.
Everybody, yes.
Jeffrey Jeff Nichols, 68, British musician and keyboardist, longtime member of the heavy metal band Black Sabbath until 2004. He was originally brought in as a second guitarist when Black Sabbath doubted whether they would even continue under that name. He then switched to bass when Geezer Butler left briefly, and then he became the band's keyboardist upon Butler's return. So quite a versatile musician.
I would say so.
The band, of course, kept the Black Sabbath name, though they did not always credit Nichols as a full member of the band, and he rarely appeared on stage proper during Black Sabbath shows. Instead, he usually played from a side stage or backstage position.
You're kidding.
No, one exception to this was the tour in support of the album Seventh Star in 1986, wherein he played on stage as an equal member of the band. And then another is a concert in May of 88, where he played bass for a charity function.
Right. Well, 80s were very synth-heavy, if you remember.
Yeah. So
I can understand what...
Yeah, now we bring him out into the light. He gets out of the shadows. It's not a shame to have a synth player. Yeah,
exactly.
Sonny Garaci, 69 years of age, was an American musician and singer with whom I have a little bit of a connection, an artistic connection. He is probably most famous as the former lead singer of such groups as The Outsiders and Climax. He was born in the greater Cleveland, Ohio area. And as a lead vocalist with The Outsiders, he recorded for Capitol Records several top 40 hits, four in all, including Time Won't Let Me, which was a big, big hit and which I used as the title track song in my film The Party Crashers.
Ah, look at that. So did you meet him?
No. Why would I have met him? It was recorded in the 60s. I made the movie in the 90s. There was no need.
Right.
Really, to meet the guy who sang. But good. Thanks for thinking of me.
I thought maybe there was a personal connection.
That is a personal connection, for God's sakes. His biggest hit song was Precious and Few, which was released in 1971 when he was the lead vocalist for Climax, and it reached number 3 on the Billboard charts. But despite the success of the single, he never released another album with that band, and the group disbanded in 75. A second album of material was almost completed, but never actually released. And I wonder if following his death, you figure someone might think, okay, we can make some bucks off that now.
Well, one would think.
In 1983, interestingly enough, he assumed the pseudonym Peter Emmett for an MCA project called The Peter Emmett Story. And it was intended as a comeback vehicle for him. He was backed in the studio by Donnie Iris's band, The Cruisers. So it kind of sounds like Eddie and the Cruisers, the plot of that movie. I guess they played in the Cleveland and Akron area before disbanding a few years later. And then in 2002, he filled in for his friend Rob Grill as lead vocalist for the very popular group, The Grassroots, and he became an honorary member of that band.
Right.
And finally, in the category of musical deaths, I would be remiss, especially for some of our listeners who are big fans of this man, if I didn't mention John Wetton, who died at 67. He was an English singer, bassist, and songwriter. Rose to fame with such bands as Mogul Thrash, Family, King Crimson, Roxy Music, Uriah Heep, and Wishbone Ash. And after his period with King Crimson, he formed and was the frontman and principal songwriter of the supergroup Asia, which, of course, proved to be his biggest commercial success and one of the most popular bands in the world. Their eponymous debut album sold 8 million copies worldwide and was Billboard Magazine's number one album of 1982. So he had a successful solo career, released a large number of studio and live albums, and, of course, a long career as an in-demand session player, collaborating with many members of prog rock bands such as Yes, Roxy Music, Brian Ferry, and Genesis.
Look at that. That's a career.
Yeah. So if I seem to be going quickly through these, you ain't seen nothing yet. Here's a lightning round of deceased actors. Are you ready?
Ready.
All right. Bjorn Granath died at 70, a Swedish actor. He hailed from the land of your people, Dean Haglund.
Absolutely.
And he was one of the stars of the seminal work Pele the Conqueror, which was one of the first foreign language films I remember going to see in the theater.
With Max von Sydow.
I saw it actually with my family, but Max von Sydow might have been there. See what I did?
See what you did?
Okay, Yorgi Teratorkin, 72 years of age, a Russian theater and movie actor. He appeared in only 25 films during his career, but they included Crime and Punishment, A Very English Murder, and Little Tragedies, all of which were released to great acclaim in the Western world. No small achievement during the height of the Soviet Union.
Right, the Cold War.
Here's one. Well, this name might not mean anything to you, but certainly his work did. How about Lars-Erik Baranet, another Swedish actor, 74 years of age? Do you know who that is, Dean Haglund?
I'm afraid I do not. I'm embarrassed.
Well, he is well known for his title role in the films about Roland Hassel and for his role as Harold Bovelius in the soap opera Skilda Vardar. I'm sure I'm doing wonderful justice to these names.
No, your accent is spot on.
Internationally, he might be most famous, Dean, for his leading role as Johan Thornblad in the television series Jordskott.
Oh, of course. Jordskott. Is that translate to... not the tunnel, the bridge.
Well, I don't know, but that's that was your top show of like the year before last.
Oh, that
top
one!
10 shows.
Oh my God, your shot. That guy died. Oh, now you tell me.
Oh my God! Yes, indeed, it's a heartbreaking moment for Dean Haglund when you remind him of the shows that he has seen, and then he finds out.
I remember it from the English translation, but yes,
you named it Jordskott on your list. Anyway,
only because I researched it.
My condolences go out to Dean Haglund as well as to the surviving members of the family so affected by the non-existent massacre in Bowling Green. Gordon Kay, I mentioned this gentleman last week, 75, English actor and singer, best known for playing Rene Artois in the British comedy series Allo, Allo. Did you ever watch this?
I watched a couple episodes. Hello, hello.
Yeah, quite popular in Europe.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're sorry to see him go.
Yes, we are. I never, I didn't really get into that show, so.
Okay, very funny man. Yeah. And we're sorry to see him go. Desmond Carrington, 90, was a British actor and broadcaster, best known for his weekly evening show, The Music Goes Round, on BBC Radio 2, a show that aired for 35 years. From 1981 until his final broadcast at the end of October when he retired this last year. And isn't that the way? He retires and then boom, he's gone.
That's it. Wow. 35 years of a radio show.
He appeared. We're catching on him. We're
catching on him.
He appeared in such films as Calamity the Cow in 1967 and also acted on TV, where he became known for his role as Dr. Anderson in Emergency Ward 10.
Was that the name of the series?
No, I'm just making it up. Yes, that's the name of the series. Why would I?
I don't know. I never heard of Emergency Ward 10. Well, it sounds really good.
We're really giving the tribute to the celebration of these people's lives that they deserve, aren't they?
Right.
I mean, it's just, look, we're in the wake of Bowling Green. We're just laughing so that we may not cry. Bob Holliday, 84, an American actor best known for playing Superman.
Right.
Oh, you knew this?
Well, I had read that another Superman, but he wasn't affected by the Superman curse.
Well, I mean, he's dead.
Well, yes. At what age?
Well, 84. He is, right. If it weren't for that damn curse, he'd live till 184. He may never have died. He played Superman in the 1966 Broadway musical, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's Superman. He was historically the next live-action Superman after George Reeves. He played Superman more than any other actor, right? Because he played it on stage for so long.
Yeah.
As well as appearing several times live in character. So another Superman dead. Frank Joseph Pellegrino, 72. No, 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 it's not his water that we all enjoy. Instead, he was an American character actor and restaurateur.
No.
A member of an early 1960s singing group called the Holidays, spelled not A-Y-S, but A-E-S, like Sundays, right? Holidays.
Right.
And he had notable acting roles, including playing Johnny Dio in Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas.
Goodfellas,
He had many appearances on Dick Wolf's Law & Order, and he played FBI Chief Frank Cubitoso on HBO's long-running The Sopranos.
Oh.
He was a co-owner of the restaurant Rouse in New York City. He wrote many books, including Recipes from the Neighborhood and Rouse on the Grill. He also produced a compact disc, An Evening at Rouse, featuring music from the Rouse Jukebox. And he even appeared recently in an episode of Kitchen Nightmares alongside Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, where he came in and yelled at him for mismanaging the kitchen.
Probably. And finally, our last actor in our lightning round, Robert. Oh, and not an actor. We're moving behind the camera now. But we'll end our lightning round here with Robert Ellis Miller, 89, an American film director. Most notably, he directed 1968's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter and 1983's Reuben, starring Tom Conti in an Oscar-nominated role.
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
Now, we stay behind the scenes, actually in post-production, with the death of Richard Portman, 82, an American sound engineer who worked on, get this, more than 160 movies between 1963 and 2004.
Good Lord.
And you know, sound engineering is quite the intricate task. And it can be
absolutely
quite time-consuming. And 160 movies this guy did. After he retired in 2004, he then taught at Florida State University. And you would hope so, given the wealth of knowledge and experience and expertise this man had.
Yeah.
He won one Oscar for his sound work on The Deer Hunter in 1978, and he was nominated for Oscars for the following films. Get this. Koch in 1971, The Godfather mm-hmm. in 72, The Candidate in 1972, Paper Moon in 73, The Day of the Dolphin 73, Young Frankenstein 74,
wow.
Funny Lady 75, Coal Miner's Daughter 1980, On Golden Pond 1981, and The River 1984. That is a variety of genres, too, that man brought his expertise
sure
to bear
is.
Upon. Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, that man, Richard Portman, a true artist, and you know, not a household name, and of course, not a face anyone would recognize, but a lot of movies that people have loved through the years are as good as they are in no small part because of his work.
Look at that.
Okay, we're coming into the home stretch now.
Great.
Emmanuelle Riva, 89, was a French actress. Her most famous work was probably her first film, when she starred in Alain Resnais's groundbreaking Hiroshima Mon Amour, which still to this day makes lists of, you know, the 10, 20 greatest movies of all time. So not a bad mm-hmm. way to start your career by starring
that's
in
true.
One of the 20 greatest films of all time. She retired for quite a few years and came out of retirement in 2012. When she received a César Award and a BAFTA Award for her lead role in Michael Haneke's multiple Oscar-nominated Amour.
Oh.
And she was, in fact, Academy Award-nominated for Best Actress for that film. She had previously been BAFTA Award-nominated for Hiroshima Mon Amour. This woman never married, no kids, like I said, retired from acting for a long time. But when you begin your career with Alain Resnais's masterpiece and you end your career with Michael Haneke's masterpiece, you will be remembered.
Yes, absolutely.
She has three French language films that have either been recently released or are about to be released, and hopefully they will see release in the English-speaking world.
Hopefully. I'm dying to see him.
You mentioned this woman last week, Barbara Hale.
Oh, yeah.
94.
You know her.
Yeah. I had not realized that she had died when you brought this up last week. But of course, famous for playing her role as legal secretary Della Street on more than mm-hmm. 270 episodes of Perry Mason.
And such a thankless job between the two. And the joke amongst me and Patty is the Della Street laugh that she had to do at the end of every episode with their stupid jokes that she had to go, ha, ha, ha. It was like a lame laugh that she dragged out almost. That's how they capped every episode of Perry Mason, practically.
You know, I've heard you do that laugh a lot of times in response to me on this show.
No, it's genuine with you. I'm just saying. Awkward.
She did win an Emmy Award as Outstanding Supporting Actress in a Drama Series for playing Della Street. She's reprised the role in 30 Perry Mason movies for television, many film roles prior to Perry Mason. I mean, she was mm-hmm. a big deal. She had played a lead role in The Window, in which she starred as the mother of a boy who witnesses a murder in a, you know, hard-boiled thriller in 1949. And she was the title mm-hmm. role in 1951's extremely popular Lorna Doone. And I can't speak to the movie, but I always enjoyed those cookies.
I'm not sure they're connected.
Really?
But, yeah, well, maybe.
They're tasty.
I should do my research.
They're very tasty. And if ever there was an invitation for you to do that phony laugh, it was right then. Mike Connors, 91, was an American actor best known for playing Detective Joe Mannix in the CBS yes. television series Mannix from 67 to 75, a role which earned him a Golden Globe Award in 1970, six straight Golden Globe nominations, four consecutive Emmy nominations. He also starred in the short-lived series Tightrope back in the 50s and today's FBI in the 1980s. His acting career spanned six decades. And, you know, when an actor's career spans six decades, as we've talked about before, sometimes becoming a star is a product of luck. But having a career that spans six decades means you know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. And you got that stick-to-itness-ness.
Yeah, yeah. And you love it, probably, right?
Yeah, exactly.
In addition to his work on television, he appeared in numerous films, most notably the 1965 World War II black comedy Situation Hopeless, But Not Serious, in which he and Robert Redford played American soldiers taken prisoner by a German villager played by Alec Guinness, one of my all-time favorites. He had also appeared in The Ten Commandments, of all things. So,
oh my gosh,
quite a career for Mike Connors. And when you speak about careers of actors, you really can't do much better than John Hurt, can you?
That's true.
We spoke a little about our personal memories of him last week. Only 77. That is not old, and I feel like we're going to be denied a lot of great work that he still could have brought us.
Yeah.
Because he was still quite active. English actor whose career again spanned six decades initially came to prominence for his supporting role as Richard Rich in the film A Man for All Seasons in 1966.
Ah, and I didn't realize that.
After that, he played leading roles as John Merrick in David Lynch's biopic The Elephant Man.
Yeah, classic.
Winston Smith in the film version of 1984.
Very scary.
Mr. Braddock in the Stephen Frears drama The Hit, Stephen Ward in the drama Scandal. He's also known for television roles such as Quentin Crisp in the television film The Naked Civil Servant, Caligula in I, Claudius, and the War Doctor in Doctor Who.
Oh, that's right. Yes, the one doctor that two episodes maybe or three, but he was quite instrumental where all the doctors come together. The magic of cinema.
His other films include, of course, the prison drama Midnight Express, the sci-fi horror film Alien, the adventure film Rob Roy, the political thriller V for Vendetta. Recently, how about Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the Harry Potter film series, the Hellboy films, and the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy big screen adaptation from 2011.
Of course. I know. That guy was working all the time.
A distinctive voice. He enjoyed a successful voice acting career in films such as Watership Down, The Lord of the Rings, the animated Lord of the Rings, The Black Cauldron, right, and the BBC television series Merlin. Hurt's last films is the Oscar-nominated biopic Jackie, currently in release. He will next be seen in the 2017 film Darkest Hour as British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain.
Wow.
He is, and that's coming out in November. He received two Academy Award nominations, a Golden Globe Award, and four BAFTA Awards, with the fourth being a Lifetime Achievement recognition for his outstanding contribution to British cinema. He was knighted in 2015 for his services to drama. And I'd like to offer up two personal sleeper picks of John Hurt, if I might.
Please do.
One came to me through our friend Tucker Smallwood, who once loaned me the DVD for this. It's a 1971, I think, British independent film called 10 Rillington Place. And the film dramatizes the case of real-life British serial killer John Christie back in the 1940s. And the serial killer is played by Richard Attenborough, and John Hurt, a young John Hurt, plays a tenant in the building where Christie lives. And it's a really, really good, interesting film, and the acting's top-notch.
Wow.
And I'd also like to recommend a film that I think has gone way too just overlooked through the years, Death on Long Island. And it's an independent film from the 90s, late 90s, where John Hurt played a British writer who doesn't use or understand anything modern. And one day he forgets his keys, locks himself out of his flat, and it begins to rain, so he goes to the cinema. And he sees that there is a movie adaptation of E.M. Forster. He doesn't like movies, but he likes E.M. Forster. So he thinks he's going to see the E.M. Forster movie, but he doesn't understand that it's a multiplex, and he goes into the wrong screen. And he enters to see the teen flick Hot Pants College 2, starring Ronnie Bostock, played by... At that point, American teen sensation Jason Priestley.
Oh, my gosh.
And John Hurt's character becomes instantly infatuated with Ronnie Bostock's beauty and obsessed with the young actor. And he begins to immerse himself in all of contemporary culture that contains Ronnie Bostock. And he even makes a trip to America to track him down and meet him. And it's called Love and Death on Long Island. John Hurt is just unbelievably awesome in this film.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah, it's really funny and really heart-wrenching and just horrifying. Finally, Mary Tyler Moore. Due to her roles on both The Mary Tyler Moore Show and The Dick Van Dyke Show, in which her characters often broke from stereotypical images of women and pushed gender norms, Mary Tyler Moore became a cultural icon and served as an inspiration for many younger actresses, professional women, and feminists. She was active in charity work and various political causes, particularly the issues of animal rights and diabetes. She was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes early in the run of The Mary Tyler Moore Show. She also,
I didn't know that.
She also suffered from alcoholism, which she wrote about in her first of two memoirs. And in May of 2011, she underwent elective brain surgery to remove a benign meningioma, I guess is how it's pronounced.
Uh-huh.
She died from cardiopulmonary arrest due to pneumonia at the age of 80, just a week before last. As an actress, her early appearances included her first regular television role as a mysterious and glamorous telephone receptionist on Richard Diamond, Private Detective. Have you ever seen this?
I've never seen this, which is weird because I normally watch a lot of that early weird stuff.
Well, it's great because on the show, her voice was heard, but only her legs appeared on camera, which created such mystique for the character. Everyone wanted to know more about who was playing this part.
Right.
And about this time, she gained great acclaim for guest starring on John Cassavetes' NBC detective series, Johnny Staccato. And of course, the next year would begin as Laura Petrie on The Dick Van Dyke Show. On the big screen, she starred in the 1967 hit Thoroughly Modern Millie. She received an Oscar nomination for 1980's Ordinary People. And she returned to movies in 1996's Flirting with Disaster, which really launched David O. Russell's career. Now, you love comedy. Nobody loves comedy more than you.
Ain't that true?
Dick Van Dyke Show and Mary Tyler Moore Show. Dean?
Holy smokes. I'm still watching it. They have it on Netflix here, and that is on my go-to queue, because if you watch it, you think, oh, well, Dick Van Dyke tripping over the ottoman, lots of physical comedy there. But think of how Mary Tyler Moore had to be both straight man and yet scenes without Dick Van Dyke, where she had to carry it with her son Rob and the neighbors. She's nailing the comedy as well. So it's often, you know, the unsung thing of like, oh, well, the straight man all they have to do is react, is often the misconception on being a straight person on a comedy team. But on her skills, you see it both. She can deliver and she can set up. So really amazing that way.
Yeah, and you're right. On Mary Tyler Moore Show, she's still very much the straight person.
She is, because all the other characters around her are, you know, zany, Ted Knight, Betty White. Like, all of them are supposed to be the eccentrics around her grounded centerness. But yet she's still delivering punchlines. She's still delivering laughs. So it was an amazing both vulnerability and observer of the world around her.
Well,
right?
Yes. I mean, you're so right. Her foibles and her flaws, which are revealed through her vulnerability, are often revealed so comedically. And
yeah.
And you know what that is actually, interestingly enough, seems to be the template for, now that you describe it, is Seinfeld. Because Jerry's the straight man on that show. But again,
absolutely.
But again, incredibly flawed and with his own foibles. But and he's not the actor that Mary Tyler Moore was, of course. But
no.
It's that same kind of setup that you described.
Yeah, absolutely. That you are reacting to the characters around you, and yet, yeah, and then you have your own situations. So you know, I think of Mary Tyler Moore and the classic clown funeral scene,
yeah,
where how she's trying to withhold laughter during the funeral, and then finally they say, "Please let out the laughs." That's what he would have loved, and then breaks down in tears like that. In terms of just a sketch, in and of itself, outside the realm of the context of the TV show, is to be studied time and time again for comedic timing and. Playing it real, like how a real the emotions were, both the laughter and the tears.
You know, following in the footsteps of Lucille Ball, not just as an unparalleled television icon in comedy, right? She also follows in the footsteps of Lucille Ball in that, along with her husband, Grant Tinker, she formed MTM, an incredibly
right.
successful production company, much as Lucy with her husband,
Desilu,
create Desilu, right?
Yeah.
MTM produced, obviously, her own The Mary Tyler Moore Show. But think about the other shows that they're responsible for producing. The Bob Newhart Show.
Yeah, absolutely.
Spinoffs from The Mary Tyler Moore Show, Rhoda, Phyllis, Lou Grant. People forget that that drama was a spinoff
right.
from The Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Exactly.
She produced Tony Randall's show in the 1970s, The Tony Randall Show. One of my favorites, if not my favorite as a kid, in the late 1970s, The White Shadow, starring Ken Howard.
Yeah.
How about another one of my favorites as a kid, WKRP in Cincinnati?
That was MTM? I didn't
MTM.
Realize that.
Then how about groundbreaking dramas? Not just Lou Grant, but in the 1980s, a show that really changed what people could expect from the quality of episodic dramas on television, Hill Street Blues.
Yeah. To think about, yeah, how groundbreaking that was in terms of not just drama, but character development and story arc, that you could run your stories over five or six episodes and that the audience would follow that.
How,
up to that time, they were thinking that that could not happen.
How about how many great actors were introduced to us through the television drama Saint Elsewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so many.
How about the groundbreaking nature of, you know, one of my all-time favorites, Remington Steele? groundbreaking not only in that it brings Pierce Brosnan to attention and stardom, but
yeah.
also the first ever of its type feminist, female-driven mystery series.
That's true.
Right? Where
yeah.
the quote-unquote male role is played by a woman. And, you know, it's an absolute, to this day, breath of fresh air in terms of its gender politics. Remington Steele, an MTM production. Also, Newhart's second hit sitcom, Newhart, produced by
Newhart.
And then
yep.
there's a whole bunch of shows that were distributed by MTM. Not produced by them, but distributed by them, such as America's Funniest Home Videos. Ever heard of that?
Yes. I didn't realize it was an MTM.
The hit sitcom that was a big comeback for Burt Reynolds' Evening Shade, and and the very beloved long-running Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. So Mary Tyler Moore, boy, if again, as I've said from time to time, if there is a Rushmore for a Mount Rushmore for television, certainly for comedic actresses, she's on it. But I would say if there's a Mount Rushmore for television, period, she and Lucy are both on there.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
That
classic
sadly brings us to the end of an hour of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. So much that we did not get to, including Oscar nominations. So we'll take the Academy to task for some omissions and some inclusions. And actually, even in a year when you're not reading hashtag Oscar so white, I'm going to take the Academy to task for not being diverse. How about that? They're still not diverse.
Okay.
And we'll also finally get to a question that came to us via email from a loyal listener about what actors expect from a director on set. I think we'll have a lot to talk about with that. So we will cover that on next week's show. We'll also finally get back to what we're reading. How about that, Dean Hagler?
Yay, that'd be good. I got a whole new library.
Of course, people can find every episode of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com. That's C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K Hollywood.com. You can even find, by the way, Dean, the first episode that we are presenting of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club on the air, a monthly podcast that will eventually have its own site and its own production entity, but we were proud to present the first one. If you enjoy this show, you might just enjoy learning about the history of the Los Angeles Breakfast Club. Spoiler alert, there's a surprise guest appearance from President Calvin Coolidge.
That's funny.
Write us, won't you? We promise to eventually get to your email if we find it interesting and if we have anything to add. That's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Write us, chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. Can people like us on Facebook, Dean?
Oh, sure can. Please like us. We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. And, of course, we're on Twitter, where you follow us at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and.
What could be more fun than that, Dean Hagelin?
I don't know. I cannot think of a funner thing.
Is there any particularly fun thing you're looking forward to this coming week?
Oh, my gosh. This is the week where this heat wave breaks, and I can wear clothes again.
Well, I'm off to a Super Bowl party because...
Oh, yes.
And happy. I hope everybody enjoyed the Super Bowl by the time they hear this. And how could you not? As long as you're a fan of the physically exploited, giving each other permanent brain damage for the benefit of billionaires, how could you not love that?
Yeah. I don't understand why that's not more popular.
All right. Until next week, I'm Phil Lernis.
I'm Dean Hagelin. See you then.
Belated spoiler alert.
It worked until you just asked, did that work?
Oh, I thought you turned me down.
Over the,
belated spoiler alert.